Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. I have invited back another repeat guest, your friend and mine, Anthony Johnston. Anthony, thank you for joining.
Hello, Scott. You're very welcome. I am fairly random, to be fair.
Aren't we all? So you're non-random in that I selected you, but
yes,
in every other way, completely random.
Been a while since I was last on, although not as long as the gap between my first and second appearances.
That's true. I'm trying to get better at luring people back, so I made sure to get you back, a little bit around a year after your last appearance. But before we
is it a year already? Wow.
I think so. Wow. Time flies when you're sitting quarantined alone.
Yes.
Crying. Before we get into the sad state of the world and Star Trek, tell the people a little bit about yourself, Anthony.
Oh, yeah. So, yes, my name's Anthony Johnston. I'm a writer and podcaster. I'm best known for Atomic Blonde, the movie starring Charlize Theron and James McAvoy, which was adapted from a book I wrote. I also write the Brigitte Sharp cyber spy thrillers. I write lots of things. I do lots of podcasts. You've probably heard me elsewhere on The Incomparable. Yeah, you know, I'm that guy.
He's that guy. He's around. Buy his books. And you're working on this episode. I forget when it is premiering, but you've been working on a special project of a short film.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm not sure whether it'll be out when this episode goes live, but that premieres on July 1st. On my YouTube channel. Yes, it's a short sci-fi film that I made with another person people will know from the channel, Moises Chuyan, and my friend the actor Casey McKinnon. And it was the whole thing was done while all three of us were self-isolating in lockdown, in quarantine. So we recorded everything using webcams over Zoom. I wrote and directed it. And yes, that will be out, as I say, as we record in a few days' time. And yeah, it's pretty exciting.
And if I post this when I'm supposed to post this, people will be listening to this around July 2nd. So you will be able to watch the short story. Not the short story. You could watch one of Anthony's short stories, but it would be kind of boring. Why don't you watch his short film and read some short stories?
Much more sensible.
Yes, I think so. I try to be as sensible as possible. Now, Anthony, I know you've been on. You're a writer. You've been on the podcast a whole bunch, and so I want to ask you a writerly question related to Star Trek, but I haven't thought of one. So I was trying to stall until something popped into my head. But do you? Here's a question that you may not have an answer to, but because I think that do you watch things? And this is, Star Trek, non-Star Trek, with your professional lenses on all the time? Or are you able to kind of disconnect and enjoy just watching or reading, a graphic novel or something? Or are you always, not that you wouldn't enjoy it, but I feel like when you are working, when it's work, it's different than just kind of consuming it for enjoyment. So are you able to kind of disconnect those bits and just kind of consume?
I am, but it depends. And I actually do have, stuff to say about this episode that we're going to talk about along those lines. Yeah, it often depends on how much I'm enjoying it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can never entirely disassociate yourself from that side. You know, if you are somebody who makes the thing that you're experiencing, it is impossible to completely divorce yourself from it. But if it's of sufficient quality and craft, then yeah, to an extent you can kind of subsume that part of your brain and just enjoy it. For example, to take a recent example that everybody loved, the film Knives Out. Mm-hmm. Which that's my genre. I write mysteries, I write spy thrillers and crime mysteries and stuff, so it's absolutely in my wheelhouse. But it was so good, so well made, that at no point did I fail to suspend my disbelief. I wasn't mm-hmm. constantly rewriting it in my head, which I have done with lesser quality movies, and yes, also with books and stuff. So, like I say, it kind of depends, but you never truly stop doing it because you can't help yourself. I do it even with music because I I'm also an amateur musician, and, you know, I've put out albums and stuff, and I was in bands when I was younger. And even when I'm listening to music, I will quite often sort of sit and think, oh, I would have done that differently, or I would have moved that part there, and you can't help it.
And I guess it's not, it is kind of a different way of enjoying it, and it also, to your point of when you're watching something or listening to something really good, I think it can deepen your appreciation because you understand all the hard work that went into the thing that is created.
Yes.
Because I think the trick, right, the trick of a creative person is you want to make it so good that nobody knows how hard it was to make. And so it just feels like it's so easy, right? And you're just kind of, the consumer is like, wow, this is great. I often feel guilty because I'm a fairly fast reader, not as fast as my wife, who's a super fast reader. But so I can read a book in, like, you know, a couple hours or a day, depending on how long it is. And then when I'm done, I think, it took that person, whoever it was, a really long time to write that book, and I just kind of gobbled it down.
It did, but, and I've seen, I often joke, you know, people say like, oh, you know, I love this book so much, I burned through it and read it in 4 hours, and I'm like, that took me a year to write. but it's, you know, it's half joking, because obviously the compliment is the fact that somebody enjoyed it enough.
Mm-hmm.
That they burned through it in 4 hours. You know, you wouldn't do that with a book you're not enjoying. Even if you're a fast reader, frankly, you might get halfway through and just put it aside if you're not enjoying it, you know, regardless of the speed you write at. So you have to, as a creator, you have to understand that that's a compliment when people say that to you. They don't mean it. They're not trying to dismiss your work. You know, they're actually trying to say that's how much they enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. It can sometimes be difficult to remember that when you think of all the hours that you put in. But like I say, I understand where the sentiment is coming from. And you're absolutely right. That's why something like Knives Out is so beloved of other writers. You know, almost every writer I know who's seen that movie has gone, my goodness, that's amazing, what a great movie, even if you're not really into the genre, because the craft of it is so incredible. You sort of sit there watching it, and I mean, and you just sort of enjoy it and you're along for the ride. But then when afterwards, you know, you have those moments when you're contemplating what you just saw, and as a writer you think, my goodness, how intricate, how much work went into that to craft it and make it as good as it was. So it does, you know, it can give you that extra appreciation. Unfortunately, of course, if you come across something that isn't very good, it also, you know, you kind of think, you lazy so-and-so, you know, you could have done better than that.
And the sad truth is that there's more bad stuff than good stuff out there, right? So that's how we know there's good stuff. There's mostly mediocre stuff, which
I was gonna say, I think there's probably an equal amount of truly bad stuff as there is of truly great stuff.
That,
and then there's
true.
A huge morass of fair to middling going on, you know, in the middle.
And that's a great segue to talk about the episode we watched today.
Spoilers.
Because it's one of those Star Trek episodes that is fine, although it's kind of, well, we'll get to it. We're going to talk about a TNG episode, The Child, which is, I didn't realize when I, the random Trek machine assigned this to Antony. Here's a peek behind the curtains for the folks listening. What I do is I send out a link to the Memory Alpha page, and then we, you know, schedule the podcast, and I forget about the episode until I need to watch it, you know, the day before or a couple hours before. So I didn't realize that this was the season 2 premiere episode.
Yes.
And so I realized that yesterday when I was watching it. And so,
which informs a lot of how it's constructed and paced, and we'll mm-hmm. get to that later, yeah.
And while I don't think this episode is particularly good or particularly bad, except for some weird, creepy stuff, it has a lot of important things to Star Trek The Next Generation that appear for the first time. Like, you know, Geordi is now the chief engineer. Riker has a beard. Guinan is a character, and Ten Forward is a place, right? That is all the first.
Oh, is this the first appearance of Ten Forward? I knew it was Guinan's first appearance. Oh,
mm-hmm.
Right. So had Ten Forward even been mentioned before this episode?
Someone
did
will
it even
me.
Exist as a concept?
But I don't think it did. I think that this was the first time it was mentioned and visited. And, of course, this is the introduction of Dr. Pulaski, robot racist, who joins the crew, and Anthony, you're a writer, so do you think that they purposefully tried to make Dr. Pulaski not so likable by being mean to Data, who is one of the favorite characters of TNG?
One of the most beloved characters, yeah. Well, I mean, for a start, I'd forgotten that Dr. Crusher left so early in the show's run.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, I thought that it wasn't until, you know, that she'd been in like the first two or even three seasons before she left. I forgot it was quite this early.
Now, apparently, the head writer for the first season and the second season, I believe, did not enjoy Gates McFadden's acting. And so he decided that she would no longer be on the show.
Huh. Wow. Well. Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out everybody else did. So the third season, she came back.
Nuts to him then, yeah, because I certainly, I was a fan of Dr. Crusher. Anyway, what I did like was that they introduced a character who didn't get on with Picard.
Yes.
Because that's kind of missing otherwise from the TNG dynamic. Yes, you know, they have their moments of being annoyed with one another and stuff. But there were certainly in season one, I don't recall any other main character who genuinely felt like they just kind of rubbed one another the wrong way in the way that Pulaski and Picard certainly do in this episode. And from what I recall, I haven't seen this episode since it aired, so. But from what I recall of the rest of the season, that was their relationship, was that it was a bit prickly. I kind of like that, to be honest. It seemed like an attempt to get something like the Kirk-Bones dynamic going. I mean, it's different, obviously, because they weren't old friends and stuff, but still, you know, I didn't mind a bit of spikiness in that relationship.
Yeah, I mean, in general, like Dr. Pulaski, except for the fact that she does not like Data for some reason. And I'm like, how can you not like Data? He's so nice.
Well, but I mean, I guess, and again, I don't know if this is borne out in the rest of the series, but I guess that you could say that that comes from her being a doctor of biology. And so, you know, her concern and her primary interest is humans and the idea that something could pretend to be or could aspire to be a somebody would be anathema to a doctor of biology.
Yes, I think you're right. And they do explore that a little bit later on in the season. So, but Dr. Pulaski, not the fan favorite character that perhaps they would hope she would be. And she leaves after this season to be replaced by Dr. Crusher, as should be. This was, I really had, once I started watching it, I remembered parts of it, but I had very little memory of it.
I had absolutely zero memory of this episode whatsoever. Like I say, I know I watched it because I watched the first, I think, three seasons of TNG when it was broadcast, but obviously that was a long time ago and I haven't really watched it since at all, so.
And then, you know, whenever I watch Star Trek, I think, oh great, this will be a nice escape from the world. I won't have to worry about, you know, whatever's happening in the world. Currently, as we record this, there is a pandemic going on. So you think, great, I'll watch an episode of Star Trek. It'll take my mind off this pandemic. And of course, the B plot is all about a plague that they do not have a cure for. And they need to transport these biological samples to like a research station so that they can get a possible vaccine. And one of the final scenes in this episode is they arrive at the research station, and Geordi says to the scientist who brought along the samples, great, now you can make a, how long is it going to take to have a vaccine for this currently incurable plague? And he says, we may never have one. And I thought, great, thanks Star Trek for bringing me right back to the current situation.
I mean, that's kind of, given the sort of show that Star Trek is, and especially Next Generation, you know, in terms of its general optimism, and particularly at the start of the series, I thought that was quite an interesting way to go. Rather than say, oh yes, you know, top men and all that, I'm sure this will have it licked in no time. To have somebody go, well, actually, it might not work, but we have to try, which I think is a good message, but that did surprise me a little, as I say, given the general overall optimism of the Star Trek world at this stage of its, you know, saga life cycle, as it were.
That's true. Usually, whenever they encounter some sort of medical issue, they just wave a tricorder at it, and it is cured, or the doctor gives you a pill and you grow a new kidney.
Right, and gives you some salad. I mean, exactly. Not even, but not even medical issues. Any issue, you know, early Star Trek, every issue is resolved by the end of the episode. So to have, and I know it's only the B plot, although at times it felt more like the A plot, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But to have, to get to the end of the episode and have that essentially be unresolved, like, yes, we've resolved this immediate task of getting the samples and all that, you know, to where, delivered to where they need to be, but there are many steps beyond this, and they may not succeed. I'd say, I just thought that was quite interesting, really.
Yeah, and Geordi seemed dissatisfied with the answer, and the officer, whose name escapes me, but is a character actor who has probably been in a million things, and has a very unique look, which I guess is kind of part of why you're a character actor, because you have a very unique
yes.
look, and you can go, hey, it's that person. And he's kind of, you know, much like Dr. Pulaski is prickly, he's a little surly as well, which I like, and they stand out from the other kind of the Enterprise crew. He's like, yes. Well, you know, we have to try, and there's no guarantees, so let's see what happens. And so I did like that.
Hester Dealt was the name of the character, and played by a guy called Seymour Cassel or Cassell, who I believe that's the only role he played in Star Trek, by the looks of it, yeah.
Yes, but he's been in like a million things, I'm sure, because that guy's face. I know that guy's face. And you will too, which, if you have not watched this episode. So let's talk about the A plot, which is so it's the season 2 opener. As you're watching this, it is clear it's the season 2 opener because it starts with a loving shot of the Enterprise and a shot of my personal favorite type of starship, an Excelsior class. I think it's the Repulse. And they're there because I guess the Repulse has the samples or something. I don't know why they're there. It doesn't really matter. But so they're picking up the samples.
I think so, yes. Yeah.
It's fine. Geordi's now the chief engineer. Hooray for Geordi. He's created this complicated containment unit to store these super deadly samples. Later in the episode, Dr. Pulaski calls up Captain Picard and says, even if the mildest one of these things escapes, everyone's going to be dead in 2 hours. And Captain Picard's like, well, what can we do about it? And Pulaski says, we can't do anything about it. I just wanted you to know.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, good to know. And so we see, this is now the A-plot, is this energy being, because Star Trek loves its energy beings, enters the Enterprise and goes down some corridors, and I kind of felt like if it was playing kind of goofy music, this could be from like any 80s movie or hijinks will ensue, but it's kind of playing creepy music, and it flies through a corridor, a couple people don't notice it. It flies through the quarters of a man who has a very hairy chest, who is sleeping, who we never, I don't see ever again. And it's like, I don't care about you, man. And then it goes into Counselor Troy's quarters. And this, so...
Yeah, I mean, that's my first question. Like, is obviously, from a production standpoint, we know why it picks Troy, because, you know, we've got to have a main character. But, like, I don't know, it just, it's one of those, you see it, is Troy the only fertile woman on the Enterprise? Like, really? What are the chances, you know?
Well, maybe her quarters are right next to this other guy's quarters.
I guess.
And it's tired. It was flying through the space. It came across this ship. I don't know how creepy this scene was supposed to be. I think it was supposed to be on the level of creepiness of there's an alien thing creeping into Counselor Troy's bed, which is one level of creepiness. But then it was also, this whole episode has this kind of, you know, lack of consent, alien impregnating someone without getting permission kind of creepiness.
Which is glossed over to an extent, yeah. It's the whole, the decision over, is this creepy or is it just scientifically fascinating, mm-hmm. is really uneven throughout the episode. I think that's one of the things that, you know, the episode could be improved if they were more consistent about that, because the child itself, what's it, Ian, could be, and at times is played to be a bit creepy. Like, because obviously it's a bit weird having this child who grows up very, very fast and all that, and clearly has some kind of purpose, but won't tell anybody what it is. Mm-hmm. And so they play that up, and it's like, okay, well, that's a bit creepy. But then they dispense with the creepiness almost immediately and instead play it for the sympathy and compassionate side of things. So it's really...
With puppies.
I mean, yeah, well, that too. But also the self-sacrifice at the end. It's just, it's really uneven. It's... Mm-hmm. It's not like you. I think this isn't a bad episode. It's not one of their best, but it's not bad. It's just there are some really odd pacing choices. But I think a lot of that is down to, firstly, as you say, it's the season premiere. So they have to get all the main characters reintroduced fairly swiftly. And they do that. They do that very well, I think. The exposition is dealt with quite efficiently. Everybody is reintroduced. You understand who everybody is, what they do on the ship. Promotions are sort of dealt with and what have you. Even the captain's log expositions aren't too wooden compared to some that we've seen. So, you know, that's all handled really well. But from a modern perspective, again, the actual scenes move so slowly that there's loads of build-up. And then very little time to actually deal with the ramifications of what happens in this episode.
Yeah, it's kind of like it forgets halfway through that this child is possibly...
Well, no, I think it remembers halfway through. It's almost like it forgets at the start, and then halfway through it goes, oh, hang on, there's a child, isn't there? We've got to deal with that.
And it might be creepy.
Yeah, because it's not until... We're almost halfway through the episode when Troy has the child.
True.
We're exactly halfway through. I timed all these. We're exactly halfway through when we first meet Ian as the young child, when we realise that he's growing unnaturally fast. That moment with Picard and Pulaski is exactly halfway through the episode. But from that point on, he has a grand total, and like I say, I timed this, he has a grand total of 4.5 minutes of screen time in the rest of the episode. And that's being generous, because a good portion of that length is other people discussing him while he just happens to be in the room and the puppies.
The puppies were cute.
It's fascinating because it feels so perfunctory. Like if this was a modern show, I can easily imagine that the birth would have occurred like 10 minutes in.
Certainly in the first act, right? Maybe.
Right. First commercial break. Mm-hmm. Or maybe not these days you have a break at the titles, don't you? But, forget that one. You know what I mean? The first proper commercial break. That would have been the birth. And then most of the show probably would have focused on the kid growing up, learning what it's like to be human. You know, a bit of sort of maybe a bit of humour, baby, a bit of creepiness, that sort of thing. But all about, what's this weird thing in the ship? With the pathogen story as the B story, where you check in every so often for 20 seconds and then you come out again. But instead, we spend loads of time on the pathogen story. Like, even though this episode is titled The Child, there are times when it feels like the pathogen is the A story and the kid is the B story. It's, like I say, I just find it absolutely fascinating, because obviously this is nearly 40 years old now. Mm-hmm. And so it shows you how much TV has changed, and it points to a sort of a more naive time, if you like, of TV and storytelling, because there's almost no misdirection. Like I say, he's kind of played up as creepy a little bit, but then they very, very quickly pull back away from that again. He doesn't, hurt the puppies. He doesn't say anything sinister other than, I'm not ready to tell you why I'm here.
Oh, yes.
When the pathogen thing goes wrong, nobody watching is in any doubt that, of course, he is to blame. Like, that's, they didn't even attempt to misdirect the viewer on that. And then likewise, and maybe this one's just me, but likewise, as soon as that becomes clear, when I was watching it, I was like, oh, so he's going to sacrifice himself.
Which he does almost immediately.
Right, yeah, he doesn't even explore any other options. So I say, the pacing is so strange and so feels very so old-fashioned to us. It feels very, very Star Trek. And maybe that's just because, obviously, this is the Star Trek I grew up with. I'll watch reruns of the original series, but this is the one that was on when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And so, this is, if you asked me to sort of describe a typical Star Trek episode and how it's paced, this is exactly what I'd remember. And now watching it again, I'm like, oh, wow, we have progressed a lot since the 1980s.
Things happen a lot faster now. It was a simpler time.
They really do. They really do. It's crazy.
And this episode also has one of the things that drives me a little batty about Star Trek, because one of the things I love about Star Trek, and I think one of the hallmarks of Star Trek, is that it is a bunch of people who are competent in their jobs and they know how to do stuff, right? And so that's, and they solve problems. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. That's Star Trek, I think, in a nutshell. And it always drives me insane when it is so obvious, as you said, what the cause of the problem is.
Like, what's different?
Exactly.
What's changed?
That's the first thing you have to ask. Like, what happened recently that might have been out of the ordinary? I don't remember. And it could be wrong, right? That's a good, you know, way of doing some misdirection. Maybe they can't, for some reason, scan the kid, so they can't figure it out until whatever. But that's the first thing they should check, and that could build suspense. But it's like, no, we don't know what could be causing this.
Yeah, they even have the doctor there when they're talking about this. The doctor is with them. And they're saying, so what could be the source of this? And, oh, man.
And she's like, what causes this radiation? And we're like, this thing that we don't have, like four things that we don't have on the ship. Yeah. Maybe it could be that weird alien baby that Counselor Troy gave birth to like 3 days ago.
The one thing we do have on the ship that we did not have before.
I don't know. I'm just spitballing here, guys. I know I'm an ensign, but... Oh, boy. But yeah, so let's talk about it. So Counselor Troy is impregnated by this glowing orb of energy, and she goes to Dr. Pulaski, which we don't see. We find out because Dr. Pulaski has joined the crew, but she didn't check in with Captain Picard. So Captain Picard's a bit peeved, and he thinks, oh, maybe... Well, he's not peeved yet. He thinks, oh, maybe she got lost or something, right? So he's like, where is Dr. Pulaski? Turns out she's in 10 forward, and now he is peeved.
Yeah. Although, if this was the first time that Tenforward had never even been mentioned before, that's... I've only just thought about that, because, yeah, I assumed that Tenforward either had been in it before this episode or had at least been mentioned. So when, if I recall correctly, the computer or whoever it is literally just says she's in Tenforward, not... You know, 10 forward, the bar that we have on the Enterprise now. So,
as you know,
his reaction of sort of annoyance is, yeah, just, you know.
It's perplexing to the first-time viewer, because you don't know what 10 forward is. And then when he comes into 10 forward, you're like, oh, she's at a bar. That's not great.
Do we see drinks when he walks in? I'm trying to remember now.
I don't know if we see... Yes, I think there are drinks on the tables.
Okay, all right. So, yeah, all right. So you find out fairly quickly then that it is a bar, all right?
Yes, and she's there with good reason, right? Because she is a doctor. And that is, I think, the interesting thing about, you know, Star Trek crews always have a doctor character whose job is slightly different than the rest of the crew, right? And who cares about the health and well-being of the crew, which is the rest of the crew is basically putting themselves in danger and actively not caring about their health.
Who counsels the counselor?
Exactly. And so she is counseling Counselor Troy, who has found herself unexpectedly pregnant. And now here is another area in which I don't think this episode has aged very well, because Captain Picard takes this information and he's like, okay, let's have a senior crew member meeting. And he starts it and he says, Counselor Troy's pregnant. We don't know why. Let's talk about the fate of this child without getting her input.
That did. I mean, they kind of focused on her. She didn't explicitly say at the end of that scene, does anybody care what I think? But that came across in the performance, I think. I think that's an area where, yes, it is terrible that all these men are having this high-level discussion without once asking her what she wants to do.
But it does save itself, because at the end, she does say, I'm keeping this child.
Right, that they were commenting on the fact that that was happening. The fact that it still happened in what is supposed to be this post-misogynist, you know, perfect utopian society is still a bit dodgy, but, you know, it was also made in the 1980s, so...
It's true. And they're discussing, well, should we let it should we let her have it? Should we terminate the baby? Like, these are weighty discussions that a mother wants to be part of, one thinks.
You would assume, yes.
And she clearly does want to, because at the end she's like, I don't care what you think. You could do whatever you want to protect the ship, but I'm having this child. And everyone's like, okay, fine.
Well, to Picard's credit, as soon as she says that, he says, well, then that's the end of the discussion.
Yes,
and
that's true.
That is to his credit, I think, that he doesn't try to dissuade her or question her or second guess her. It, just as soon as she says, I've made up my mind, he's like, right, well, fair enough then.
And Riker is perturbed because he, I think we know this from the first season, they had a romantic
That happens in the first season, doesn't it?
Yeah. Right, yeah, I think so. And so he is like, who's the father? I'm surprised. And I love Counselor Troy's reaction of, you're not as surprised as I am.
Yeah.
Which kind of shuts him down a bit.
Like, imagine oh, okay. my surprise number one.
Exactly. It's not all about you, Riker. but he's like, oh, and then so she has the baby. Captain Picard orders some security to be there, which I think is an appropriate precaution. Dr. Pulaski makes them wait outside, which is fine. And having been in a delivery room a little under a year ago, I find it creepy that Riker is just kind of peering through the window without any permission.
Right. Well, and I also found it just weird that the sick, they're effectively in sick bay, and it doesn't appear to actually be set up for any kind of childcare whatsoever.
Yeah, because Dr. Pulaski says, oh, we need to get you to the maternity ward or something, which turns out to be, you know, the sick bay set.
Just sick bay, yeah.
It's like, okay. They have a fancy chair, but I don't know.
Yes, this chair is the maternity ward.
I guess so. It's a very small maternity ward. We don't get a lot of pregnancies on the Enterprise.
Well, that's probably true.
That is true. One imagines they have very effective contraceptive in Star Trek times. So if you don't want to get pregnant, you probably don't get pregnant unless a passing by energy being decides that it wants to experience humanity and impregnate you to live through the cycle. You know, these things happen in space.
Right. That's another thing coming at it from the modern perspective of knowing Star Trek just in general without even knowing this specific episode. The moment it happens, like, again, I was just immediately, oh, it wants to experience what it's like to grow up as a human. That's clear, you know, how could it be anything else?
Yes, because they spent a little time thinking, oh, is this like some sort of an attack? Well, that was Worf, right? And it seems like the worst possible way to attack a ship, right, is by impregnating one person and creating one being and waiting to be born, even though it's a very quick cycle. I guess we kind of skipped over the fact that the odd thing, other than, of course, Counselor Troy has been impregnated without knowing, is that the baby is developing very quickly. And so she goes from, you know, just being pregnant to giving birth in, I think, 36 hours or something like that.
Yes.
And she gives birth and feels no pain. And she's not uncomfortable as she's pregnant. And having, not that I want to keep bringing up my own experience, not that I was pregnant, but I was in living with a woman who was pregnant, who experienced much discomfort and much pain during birth. So it is unusual to not experience either of those things during
which
any
they
point.
Do comment on, to be fair. You know, Pulaski does remark upon that, And then, shortly after, Pulaski and Picard are like, oh, let's go and see Deanna and see how she's doing.
Baby, yes.
And, of course, that's the halfway point, when they go into her apartment. Not apartment, you know, in her rooms.
Her quarters.
Quarters, that's the word, thank you. And there's the child. Suddenly, what is it, 4 hours old, I think Pulaski says?
Yes, and he's like four years old.
But presenting as 6 years?
Something like that.
Yeah.
He can talk. And that's so. I do enjoy Captain Picard with children because he doesn't really, he's not very comfortable with children. And there's also a whole Wes story that I guess we should touch on, which I remember because of, there's a very uncomfortable scene in the turbo lift with Captain Picard and Wes.
That scene was weird. Like, you can literally watch them move around each other to hit their marks. It's just.
Mm-hmm. It's not
so
good
strange.
But it is clear Captain Picard is uncomfortable with his child. And then the child says, like, hello or something. And he looks at Troy and he says, it can talk, or he can talk, or something like that.
I can't remember whether he says he or it now.
I don't remember either. He probably says he, but because I think, once again, you're right. They didn't really decide, should this be creepy or just of scientific interest? If it was creepy, he would have said it, right? But
true.
I think he probably didn't. And that's, I think later on, he comes to talk to Ian again and asks him a series of questions that says, you know, why are you here? And Ian says, like, something like, you know, it's dinner time. and Captain Picard says, no, I mean, why are you on the Enterprise? And he says, because I live here. Which, you know, are you would expect a child to answer these questions in such a way.
Yeah, no, that actually felt quite real. Mm-hmm. Trying to get an answer, straight answer out of a kid. Yeah.
No, that is not, you know what I'm asking you. And this is, and you mentioned this earlier, actually, I believe this is the creepiest moment in the entire show, other than the scene at the very beginning where the orb is under the covers. Counselor Troy says to Ian, no, I think he means, why did you choose to come on to the Enterprise? Are you ready to, you know, share why you have done all of this? And Ian looks at them all and says, not yet.
Yeah, I'm not ready yet.
Yeah, that's creepy.
It was, although the fact that Troy and this child, we're told, is an exact biological match to her. It's half Betazoid in the same way that she is. But the fact that she has her powers, her empathic powers and what have you, she surely at some point could have said to the captain, no, it's all right. I can sense that he doesn't mean us any harm. Because, you know, she spent the entire first season basically going, I sense pain, I sense hatred, and then in this episode, she doesn't do that at all, which felt really strange. Like, you are the one person on the ship who has the power to reassure everybody that this is not dangerous.
Yeah, and I feel like they were, and maybe this is just me reading into it, because I know Counselor Troy, but they showed, you know, there were a bunch of shots of, like, the little embryo developing, and then, you know, showing the little face, and then showing Counselor Troy, and I thought, you know, cutting back and forth between the two, and I thought, well, are they trying to tell me that they're, like, establishing an empathic bond, and she's kind of sensing the child that's growing inside of her more than you normally sense a child growing inside of you, on a different level, I should say, not more. And then she says later in that scene, I can sense that he knows why he's here.
Yeah, she says the answer's within him, and I'm sure when he's older he'll be able to articulate it. But again, it's not kind of, I don't know, it just felt like really weird that after a whole season of banging on about her powers,
she's sensing emotions all over the place.
Right, she doesn't actually use the word sense at any point, and it's like, you could have put it in here. This is one of the places where it would have been appropriate.
Yes, it's very strange. And meanwhile, in the cargo bay, they've got like a weird contraption full of deadly pathogens, and all of a sudden, the deadliest one, the plague that they're trying to help the planet that is suffering through the plague, starts to grow exponentially, which they can't figure out why. The containment's going to be destroyed, the containment field. Geordi's like, well, it's not going to breach the, you know, the fancy shell that I've made around it. And Hester Delph is like, oh, it will. And then we're all going to die.
Yeah, he didn't, like, some kind of evidence for his assertion there would have been useful. He literally just goes, no, it will. It will. And, like, the suggestion of, well, why don't we just jettison it? The counter-argument to that made no sense to me. It's like, oh, because then, like, any planet or ship that it happens upon, it will kill. Well, then just strap a bomb to it.
Well, you're in a starship that has phasers. Just shoot, you know, transport it into space and then burn it to heck.
Disintegrate it or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, odd.
Or also, you have phasers in the ship. Why don't you just shoot it? Well, I guess if you let it out, you might. That wouldn't be a
then
good
you
idea,
risk. Yeah, no, I can understand
space,
that would be a risk.
In space.
But yeah, airlock it. You know.
Exactly. But yeah, he rejects that out of hand, mostly because, I believe, Anthony, they needed this ticking clock and the danger.
Again, from a production standpoint, of course, I understand why these arguments are rejected.
Yes, but it doesn't make any sense. And don't be too nervous, dear listener. The crew of the Enterprise must not all die because of a horrible plague that is unleashed at the end of The Child, the season 2 opener. You will be shocked to learn.
Yeah.
They quickly, although not as quickly as one would hope, figure out that the radiation that's causing this malfunction, or I guess it's not a malfunction, but stimulating the growth, is emanating from the titular child, Ian. They rush up to see him. Actually, they don't actually rush up to see him. He senses something's wrong, decides that he's going to die.
Yeah, no, he's just alone with Troy at that point. Yeah.
Yes. And Troy makes a logical leap here because he says, oh, I have to leave, something like that. And she says, oh, you're going to die, which was not what I was thinking he meant, but she was right because he, I guess, shuts himself down.
Well, and again, you know, she could have, I assume that she could sense that he was, you know, about to sacrifice herself. But once again, she could have said that.
And then it would have made sense because they're like, oh, she intuited that with her empathic skills. So she calls for Dr. Pulaski because her son is dying, so that makes sense. She comes with Riker and Data, who were at the birth, so that kind of makes sense. And then everybody in the room suddenly realizes, oh, Ian. Maybe he's the reason that this is happening. And they realize that after Troy says, he's the reason that this is happening.
Yes.
And
just in case you weren't clear.
Exactly. In case you are at home thinking, what is going on? And he dies, but he doesn't really die. He turns back into his little glittery energy self, hangs out in Troy's hands for a moment.
Has a quick telepathic conversation with her, yeah.
Yep, and he's like, thanks a lot. I gotta go.
And see you later.
See you later. The containment unit is stabilized, crisis averted. I'm sure you are wondering, listener, do they deliver those samples to the medical research station? And the answer is yes, they do. And the only thing that we didn't talk about is Wesley Crusher throughout this episode is kind of having a moment of crisis in that his mom has left. The actress was asked to leave, but the character has left the Enterprise to be head of Starfleet Medical. And of course, Wes is left on the Enterprise, so he's going to go join his mom, or he's supposed to, but he has a conversation with Guinan where she says, you know, follow your heart, basically. And then he's like, oh, you're right, I should stay on the Enterprise. I need to talk to Captain Picard to get his permission. Captain Picard is like, your mom would be really mad at me if I just told you to do this. He doesn't say that, but you read the...
Go and ask your mother first.
Exactly. And then there's a kind of funny scene where on the bridge, Captain Picard, well, there's a scene where Wesley is in the ready room with Captain Picard and he asks for permission to stay on the Enterprise. Picard does not answer him but goes onto the bridge and, you know, kind of I was gonna
basically
say,
roasts him, yes, in front of the entire bridge crew.
Exactly. That was what I was trying to look for. I was gonna say humiliate, but it was like
no, it's friendly. It's clearly a good natured.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why I didn't want to say humiliate. And so he says, you know, everybody, Wesley Crusher wants to stay on the Enterprise, but that's gonna cause work for everybody else, and I don't know if, you know, who's gonna, you know, watch after him, who's gonna do his studies with him, and that'll obviously be Data, and who's gonna, you know, care for his personal development, Riker probably, but the big question is, who's going to tuck him in at night? That was probably my favorite part. And then Worf says that he will do it.
I want to say, and I'm a little bit biased here, as people may know, Will is a friend of mine. I mean, I didn't know him at the time, obviously, but I've gotten to know him, you know, like over the years. And but I honestly think that this is considering he was what, 15, I think
at
the point when this was filmed, this is a good performance. You know, this is a good, because it could be really, really over the top and horrible, and it's not. It's a really good, measured performance for this particular story and, you know, sort of reflecting this particular character. And I know, and Will, I also know, would be the first to admit that, you know, his performance wasn't always this measured and mature. But I think in this episode, he actually does pull it off really well, especially the scenes with Guinan.
I was going to say, yeah, I think he has the opportunity in this episode to act against two actors who really bring it out, right? Not, I don't want to lessen his work, but I think that, you know, when you're working it kind of amplifies you. So Whoopi Goldberg has always been great as Guinan, and many other roles, but we're talking about Star Trek here. And so that she has a conversation with Wesley Crusher, and that's a really great scene. And so that's the episode. That's the child. I think you can tell our thoughts of it are kind of, it's fine.
Yeah. You know, but like I say, I think it is also a product of its time. You know, you've always got to take series this old in the context of when they were made, and mm-hmm. compared to the 1960s series, The Next Generation did feel very, very modern. You know, thoroughly modern, yes, compared to the original series. And so it's natural that now, 40 years on, which is even further, obviously, apart than this and the original series, it's natural to look at it with modern eyes and go, oh, wow, this feels really old-fashioned.
Anthony, this was a lovely conversation, and I appreciate you joining me to talk about Star Trek.
Oh, thank you, Scott. It's always fun for me to come on and, sort of geek out a bit about Trek with you.
Well, you have an open invitation roughly every year or so. We want to leave the people wanting more, Anthony.
It's a deal.
We don't want to flood the market.